Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'll be speaking tonight. This is my annual philosophy lecture. And I'm going to be speaking on the question, who are we? I always like real small topics. So I'm going to start with this, and I'm going to lay out my assumptions. My first assumption is we've been making up things as we go along for the last 5,000 years. We're not, we're relied on intuition. Now, why did we even start doing it? We started doing it because, you know, recorded history, why did that start? I think because some historians began to wonder whether we couldn't learn something from all the mistakes that we were making. So they probably were somewhat more pessimistic than the usual person. The people who created the legends and the myths weren't quite as pessimistic as the historians. So can we learn something from this? That was, I think, the start of trying to use your intuitions to explain what's going on. Now, most intuitions don't travel very far. They're good for you personally, but they're not really good for anybody else. It might look nice if you look up in the sky and you say, "Yeah, the sun looks like an egg. Somebody laid an egg," and tell a whole story about it. And, you know, some people will listen to that, but it doesn't do them much good in their life, and so it fades away. But the irony of this is, why do we do this? Why do we come up with these explanations and then try to get other people to believe in them? Well, I think the first reason is because if it's just your intuition, you wonder whether it's true or not. And the more people you can convince that it's true, the more you can believe in your own intuition, right? So intuitions rely for their strength upon getting a number of people to believe in it. Now, this is very ironic in its way because, well, it's so much like online dating. No? We use an attempt to get people to believe in the myth that we want to be. You know, who am I? Well, this is who I am. And then an online dating, we explain exactly who we are over here, which has some relationship to reality, but not that much. And one of the great ironies of online dating is that if you actually get someone to believe that this is who you are, you lose faith in them because you know that you're lying, and so you know that they can't tell that you're lying, and so there must be something wrong with their perceptions. So we spend a lot of energy doing this, and we don't get anywhere because whenever we get where we wanted to be, it proves useless. And I think a lot of our attempts with intuitions to try to understand the world are very similar to that. But intuitions are kind of, you know, they're fun. They're fun to come up with. I had a history teacher in high school who just loved it. You could tell when he was about to, I'd say tell a whopper, but he would say explain reality about something. And I'll only tell one of them, but because it was just so charming to me as a lawyer. He said, he was talking about the Civil War in America, and he said, Abraham Lincoln was such a, admired John Marshall, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, so much that when he had to impose martial law, he named it after him. Chief Justice John Marshall was the fourth Chief Justice, by the way. It wasn't the first, but anyway, that's the way the story came down. And he was very pleased with this. And, you know, these quirky intuitions about how to explain things, they're kind of charming in their way. But, you know, when somebody really enjoys their quirky intuitions a lot, they kind of begin to think that they're the smartest person in the room all the time. And we all know where that leads. So something changed about 2,500 years ago. Not with very many people, but with a few people. And that was, they began to think, you know, maybe we can test other people's intuitions. Maybe we can use reason. Reason had already been around for a long time, of course. We use reason to figure out how to get food, etc. But we can use this reasoning capacity we have to try to figure out whether an intuition makes any sense or not. And so science and reasoning got started. We mostly use experimentation, reliable evidence, and everything to try to become, to have a reliance on this theory. But there's another part of it that I think is even more important, which is clear conceptual thinking. And I'll get back to that again. But you can see it's exactly for the same reason that we wanted to get people to believe in our intuitions, the more the merrier. And that is, we can rely on those intuitions if we get a large number of people to believe in it. Well, in science, you don't need anybody's opinion. You know, there can be a society that believes in the flat earth, you know, and they really don't cause anybody any harm at all unless they're working for NASA. Yeah. So we don't care really. Most intuitions are not that relevant to the rest of us, and people can believe them. It's okay. It doesn't matter. But if we want to have an idea about what our shared reality is, that objective thing, and we think it's objective, a lot of people conclude it's not, of course, with their intuitions. But we think it's objective. And if we want to get there, we need to have something reliable. So we've got evidence, we've got logic, we've got reasoning, and then, as I said, clear conceptual thinking to try to sort out what is internally consistent in a theory and what is externally consistent, the old scientific approach to testing their hypotheses. Now, that's what we're going to do. But before I go tonight, we're going to talk a little bit more about that completely and then talk about who we are in relationship to our intuitions versus our reasoning. I'd like to make it clear that this reasoning part, the popularity of reasoning, is still a very small percentage of the population. And even a large number of the people who are scientific are very intuitional about what they do too. And in addition, they want everybody to believe in what they say about reality, which is not necessary because you need to believe in the reality. You can't see me from there? I'm not worth looking at. So shall we start the slideshow? Yeah. So I have got some pretty pictures here for you. Just to give you an idea about who we are, just visually, I'm not going to talk about them at all. And now I'm going to explain why I'm going to have these pictures. These pictures are across human culture, who we are. They're there to dazzle you when you don't want to listen to what I'm saying, and to distract you, because I want you to see something beautiful, because I'm going to be talking about a lot of the foolish things that we do. But, you know, we also have done a lot of beautiful, cool things as human beings. And I think it's kind of important to think about that, too. You know, I think about it like a batting average. Yeah. You know, what percentage of the time are we getting hits and what percentage of the time are we striking out with these ideas? And so I think we have a pretty good batting average, actually. And I think it keeps improving. I think we're doing very well, in spite of the fact that I'm going to suggest in a very short amount of time three big ideas to get rid of altogether that are in our way. But since we're doing well, you know, I think we should all be very comfortable that we're doing well as a race, and that who we are as a human race, we're doing quite well. And how can we know that? Well, we can compare it to history, so we can say, how did we used to be? You know, you can say quite clearly, if you go back the 5,000 years that I'm talking about, that we're probably only 5% as stupid as we were then. You know, which is pretty good as far as slaughtering each other goes. You know, I think that the evidence, the archaeological evidence, is that it used to be, you know, 20% of the people died violently, and now we're down below 2%. So we're doing well. So we're not as stupid as we were before. So I think that we should at least conclude that our batting average, from that batting average, that we are out hitting the orangutans. So we should feel comfortable that we're moving progressively. So let's talk about clear conceptual thinking. And as I said, you can be distracted by all the beauty behind us. So clear conceptual thinking is a way of thinking through an idea in a way that makes it clear that it either makes sense or doesn't make sense. You go by the assumptions that you're given. You compare the assumptions to what you're trying to describe, and then you make a conclusion. Now, One of the things that I like to talk about in who we are is just the very basic idea about it. You know, we're basically individual minds. And we think of ourselves in many, many different ways. But there's one nice thing about being an individual mind. So nobody can take your place. No. You're indispensable to yourself because only you can live your life. Now, we give away a lot of power over our lives to other people. We're obedient, and I'm going to get back to that. But in giving away that power over our lives to other people, we really don't give them any power at all. Because we're always just like a two-year-old inside. We can always say no. No, and we do. We pretend we're going along with somebody, but we really don't. And we do we obey externally, but we don't really do it internally. And so what's crucial is what's going on inside of our minds. So who we are individually is individual minds. We each have our own point of view. Now, ironically, one of the biggest beliefs emotionally that people have is that we are the center of the universe. I mean, or the one person is the center of the universe. Now, this is where clear conceptual thinking comes in. You don't even have to be that clear about it. You can't have 8 billion centers to the universe. So we can't all be the center of the universe. And good luck to anyone who tries to convince other people that they are the one center of the universe and that everybody else isn't. Those kind of cults usually top out at about 1,000, 2,000 people that you can convince, and after that, you kind of fail. So nobody ever gets close to 8 billion to convince them. So we have this idea, and why do we have that idea? It's very simple. Our experience is that way. Everything is going on in our own heads. I mean, we experience information that comes in from the outside, but our perception of it and everything, we turn it into perceptions and our feelings about it, it's all inside our own heads. So as individual minds, we have that experience. Now, how can we define that individual mind? Well, that's what everybody disagrees about. What's consciousness? Are we just an accident of nature that dies, or do we live longer? So I'm going to go into that a little bit later. But let's talk about who we are collectively for a little while, going back to the human race. Well, we think about ourselves as families, tribes, nations. We have all kinds of groupings. But one of the things that we don't think about clearly is that none of those groupings have any experiences whatsoever, right? There isn't a national mind that thinks, and we're all part of it. We all individually experience whatever we do nationally, or everybody watches the Super Bowl, and so we say, oh, we're all experiencing the Super Bowl together, but everybody has a different feeling about it. Some people are very annoyed about the Super Bowl being on. Other people are excited about it being on. Some people are happy for the one side or the other side. So everybody's experience of this thing is different. There isn't a universal experience of anything. Every experience is individual. So when we think of ourselves collectively as who we are, then we are mushing together our experience. A lot of times there's some beautiful analogies about this that are used by spiritual teachers. They say, we are like individual consciousness, and there's a universal consciousness, and we meld into that, we mold into that, we become one with it. Now, we can have some emotional experiences like that, but the analogy is often used that it's like an ocean. Okay, so let's go into that analogy. An ocean is made up of molecules of water, right? Individual molecules of water. If you take away all the individual molecules of water, there's no ocean. The ocean is not anything except for the individual molecules of water, just all in one location. But while I'm talking about water, I want to talk about another idea that comes up a lot, and that is, if you talk about the rules of science, which I'm going to go into a little bit later, talk about the rules of science, I think we have to also remember that this is a new experiment too. It's only 2,500 years old. And a lot of the ideas that we take for granted are only a couple hundred years old. And one of those ideas is the law of entropy, which I'll talk about in a little while. But part of that law, not part of the law of entropy, But part of what we say is like water always flows downhill. So that's pretty accurate. That's what gravity does. Gravity always makes water flow downhill. But that's not really true on the molecular level, is it? Because there's evaporation of water. The water molecules go up in the air, and then they climb over here, and then they fall back down onto the earth, and then they roll downhill again, but then they go up in the air again. So water does not always flow downhill. Water goes in a lot of different directions. So when we get back to the law of entropy, maybe there's some exception to the law of entropy like that. We think that water always flows downhill. We think entropy always flows in one direction too. But there might be some other way of understanding that later. We're only a couple hundred years into it. And I think the reason I mention that is because it's very important when we talk about any ideas that, as I said at the beginning, we're all making this up as we go along. Oh, there's San Francisco. So I thought, you know, pyramids. No, wait. This is our version of a pyramid, right? So what are the three ideas? See, the three ideas, I think, we can get rid of three ideas. They're very popular ideas. They're very almost universal in their different varieties. But if we get rid of three ideas, and not only do these ideas not make any sense, but they get in our way in our pursuit of happiness. If we get rid of those three ideas, I think we could all get along. Even though we would still have thousands or millions or billions of different ideas about life. As long as we don't include those three ideas, we could get along. Now, I don't think a world government is a good idea. I do think one of my goals is, you see, I'm a mergers lawyer, or I was a mergers lawyer, mergers and acquisitions lawyer. And so my job was to try to find common ground in any deal. And some of the time, the most valuable advice I could give to a client was to say, there's no common ground. You're talking at odds with each other, and you'll never come to an agreement. So you could argue for years about this and never get anywhere. But I could also point out what it is that it's in the way. If something's in the way, fine, we can take it out of the way. So that's partially what I wanted to talk about tonight, because I see three ideas in the way of having a merger so that we can have a human civilization that everybody is kind of, you know, okay with. 80% of the antagonism, not 100%, but 80% of the antagonism between different cultures could disappear if these three ideas came out. So they're big ideas, obviously. Now, the first idea is the tyrant king. Almost every description of the ultimate authority, the divine authority, is that he behaves like a tyrant king. Now, I think it's perfectly understandable that 5,000 years ago, the people who were making things up as they go along would come up with this idea. Why? Because every single person who had power probably behaved like a tyrant king. And so they probably could not imagine that anybody with even more power than those kings wouldn't be a tyrant king. And I think if you think about it, say, the psychology is pretty obvious. Why do usurping individuals who take on the power of a tyrant king, why is it that they behave like tyrants? They behave like tyrants because they know they cheated to get that power. They know that their power is illegitimate. And so they got to keep everybody off guard. They got everybody off balance. And they have to keep things, you know, uncertain. And so their behavior is going to be based upon the fact that they are actually illegitimate holders of power. Now, if the theory, the intuition about the world, the universe, and everything is that there's an ultimate authority who's in charge, that authority is often said to be omniscient and omnipotent. Why would he be insecure? Nobody could take anything away from him. He could always do what he wanted to. There's absolutely no reason for him to act like a tyrant. But he's not an emperor with no clothes. He's an emperor fully dressed. You know, he doesn't have a problem. And he certainly isn't going to worry about anybody taking his place because he knows that can't happen. So there's absolutely no reason for the personality of that person to be like a tyrant king. Now, you'd think that it wouldn't be too hard to get rid of that idea. But you know, we're kind of fond of that idea for no really good reason. But we're fond of that idea because we kind of want to outsmart this character. No, we do. Almost every religious idea, they have a set of rules. And if you follow the rules and you get over the line, you get the reward. And if you're below the line, you get the punishment, right? And so where does every believer go? Do they aim for as high up as they can get? No, they dance right along the line the entire time, as close to the line as they possibly can, because everybody believes that all the fun is underneath the line. And the stuff above the line is just what you have to put up with, because there's a tyrant king out there that's going to nail you if you don't do it. So, and this implies something about us. One, you know, we think we're smarter than that omniscient person, which doesn't really make sense. That's a good way of thinking about an internal inconsistency, right? So this idea about a tyrant king is just something that has scared us silly for a really long time, and it doesn't make any sense. And I'll get back to that later. What would happen to religious ideas if that idea went away? Because there's a related idea that will also have to go away, and that's rewards and punishments. Every explanation of life has rewards and punishments in it, every single one. And why? Because every single one of those explanations is somebody's intuition about life, and they want to get people to adjust to that idea, to believe in that idea, to support themselves in believing in that idea. And what are rewards and punishments for? What do we use them for? We use them to get other people to do what we want them to do. That's what we do it for. If there was no reason to reward or punish anybody, that would all disappear. And I don't think that there is a reason in life, the way it actually is, to reward or punish anybody for it. So this whole idea, which is used in law, it's used in politics, and I'm not going to talk about that part of it, but it's used by everybody because we're trying to get people to agree with what we want to do. Now, where does our discomfort come from with these big ideas? It really comes from the fact that other people are doing what they want to do rather than what we want them to do. We go back to being the center of the universe again, right? So this way of thinking about life, and it takes a certain amount of maturity to realize that if you're not the center of the universe, that there's 8 billion people out there, and that they're not part of an objective sort of standard of something, that you're going to have to allow them to live their lives the way they want to live their lives, to the extent that's politically and socially acceptable. Of course, we can't have total chaos. Society would never accept that. But we could do it knowing why we're doing it, knowing that we're making it up as we go along and not look for some big philosophical reason for doing it. So rewards and punishments is the second idea that has no real basis in the shared reality. And we feel that way about animals. We feel that animals don't need to be rewarded or punished for anything that they do. We may dislike them if they live with us, if they do certain things, and we reward and punish them to change their behavior. But in general, we don't feel that way about animals. And the third idea is the good and evil dichotomy. We look at good and evil as two opposing forces. But I don't think that's the right way to understand what's going on in life. Good and evil are a lot like hot and cold. So what's hot and cold? There's an objective reality to hot and cold. It's the temperature of an object, the internal motion of an object. And so we have a scale of, you know, all the way down to Kelvin, zero Kelvin, where you have no activity whatsoever, and then the more internal activity there is, the higher the temperature is. And what is hot and what is cold? What is hot is wherever we're standing on that spectrum, above us, sufficiently above us is hot, sufficiently below us is cold. So our temperature is 98.6 degrees. We think anything over 120 is pretty hot. We think anything under 32 degrees is pretty cold. But if our body's temperature was 150, then we would think 120 is cold, and we would think that 200 is hot. So there's an objective reality, and then there's a subjective viewpoint based upon our own internal activity. I think that's a really good way of looking at good and evil, that you just are, you live life a certain way, and it's related to the reality of what's effective and what's ineffective in trying to be happy in life. The inherent goal, this idea has been around for a long time. The inherent goal in life is happiness. It's kind of ironic because it's just an emotion in our heads, right? But that's what we're always going for. That's what all of our desires are for, is to create that emotion in our heads. It's a very complex explanation, though, that goes with that. There are certain patterns to what we do, but that basic idea is always there. And if we fulfill our desires, we experience happiness. If we don't fulfill the desires, we experience pain. But why this has been confusing in religion, sometimes people say virtue is its own reward, but almost nobody believes that. No. But that's because we don't quite have a very clear idea. We have a foggy idea about what virtue is and what happiness is and what our desires are. And we have such a foggy idea about it that sometimes people say desire itself is the source of all of our suffering. So if desire itself is the source of all of our suffering, then our human lives are worthless because we're just desiring all the time. Our human lives are, the whole point of what we do has been an illusion. And let me say that that idea is a subtler version of the tyrant king. Because if the whole thing's just some divine joke, why we did all this, you know, it was a deception, devious. We were fooled into thinking we were individuals when we weren't. We were fooled into thinking that we wanted things when we didn't. Now, that's also just like a tyrant's behavior and certainly would not fit with anybody who had any realistic amount of power. So those are the three ideas. The tyrant king, rewards and punishments, and the good and evil dichotomy. I think if we don't look at it as a dichotomy, it's very interesting, of course, because evil usually attracts our attention much more than the good part does, as I said before about the line. Why are we so interested in evil? We are interested in evil just the way, you know, say Lord Voldemort in Harry Potter. Why is it that all those other wizards follow this guy who causes them pain and suffering? Why? Because he gives them permission to be cruel to others. Right? And I think this is exactly what the basic idea is behind that idea about the evil one. He gives you permission to be cruel. Where's this cruelty? Very interesting. You will find, and if you study all the lists of vices in all the religious ideas, you know, the top 10 list, you know, sloth, gluttony, you know, lust, all those usual things. Pride, don't want to be proud of yourself. Those things are considered, you know, the top 10 list of vices that are in your way. What are they in their way of? They're in your way of becoming obedient to the tyrant king. So it's true. Okay. So they're in your way. But nobody ever mentions cruelty. You can go out and search. If somebody finds it on one of those lists, please tell me. Because I did a lot of searching, never found cruelty on any of the lists, and cruelty is absolutely the number one thing in the way of the enjoyment of our lives. Because what is cruelty? Cruelty is somebody else taking pleasure in your being in pain. The last thing in the world you want is to somebody, I mean, if somebody callously does it, if a tornado blows through and you think the tornado it was done on purpose against you, you don't like it. If it's just an accident of nature, you're a little bit, you know, you're still mad about it, but you're not as mad as if somebody's intentionally doing it, right? But somebody intentionally trying to make you be in pain and taking pleasure from it is about the worst thing that we ever experience in life. And yet it doesn't make our list of top 10 vices. And why? Because we want to have permission to be cruel. And I'm going to explain that a little bit later. Because it's an important part of our psychology that we can think our way out of, but you really have to think your way out of it. It comes naturally to think this way. So those three ideas can be eliminated. And what would happen? Well, the goal, as I said before, is can we set this up so that we have a culture that goes across all of humanity, that we can all agree on certain things and agree to disagree about other things. And it shouldn't be too hard. We have a little bit of experience with this in a democracy. Of course, we're losing our taste for democracy right now because it seems easier to just hit other people over the head than it is to try to get them to agree with things. But that's because you're trying to get them to agree to things that people will never agree on. So like a good mergers lawyer, say, okay, that's an idea that's a non-starter. Just forget about the deal. You're not going to have the deal if you think that that has to be on the table. But these three ideas, actually, because they don't make sense and because they get in the way of our happiness, can be taken off the table. Now, a lot of people say, you know, when you say things like that, George, it just sounds so ridiculous. How do you expect to revise religions on some of their basic ideas? I said, well, you know, it's been done before. Human sacrifice used to be part of a lot of religions. And, you know, it's lost its luster in the last couple thousand years. So there are ideas that you can take out of the idea and still keep what it is that was going on that was important there. So I would say that the vast majority of people will still be intuitional and therefore religious in their approach to life, in their beliefs in life. And they will have an idea that there's some divine authority, there's some afterlife, and that virtue is the path to get the reward of going to the afterlife. Now, I know that's internally consistent with what I said about rewards and punishments, but I don't expect that part to disappear. So people will have that basic approach, but it's not going to get in the way of other people. They'll still want to proselytize and come to your door and ask you to join because it still will make them feel better the more people agree with this one approach, because that's the way intuitions work. But they will now have the personality of their divine authority to be of a sterling character. He won't possibly think that other people should be forced to believe in him. He knows he's not Tinkerbell. You know? It's if you believe in him, that doesn't make him exist. And he dies if you don't believe in him. That can't be. That doesn't make any sense. And so that idea can be taken off. He's probably got a very nice personality if he exists. And so you don't need to worry about him. You know, and I think the Christians are in pretty good shape on this one because Jesus himself said, you know, just imagine the best human father that you've ever met and multiply that 70 times 7 times, and that's what my father's like. All I have to do is get rid of all the other descriptions and just stick with that one. And you know, everything would be fine. So it's something that's doable, not like in the next 10 minutes. But, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years, you know, it could easily leach out of the ideas. And if you say, my God is not dumb enough to create us all one way and then realize he's made a bunch of mistakes and therefore has to have a bunch of rewards and punishments, incentives in order to get us to do what he wanted to do from the start. So he can't possibly have that idea either. And so once you say, no, our God is so smart, he did it exactly the way he wanted to, there's no need for rewards and punishments. There's no reason for incentives to change anything. It's already done exactly the way he wanted. So with that, you don't really have an argument with everybody else to get along with. Okay, so that's one group, the largest group that would be left. Then you'd have secular scientists. The secular scientists' basic bottom line is that there's that we're basically an accident of nature, that there's determinism, that we have physical laws that govern everything, and that we are an accident after a long period of entropy, which makes us pretty lazy looking, I think. But after a long period of entropy, we've come up with this. Because it's based on reason, at least theoretically, there's no reason to proselytize. There's no reason to get other people, you know, to believe in what you think. Now, as I said, the habit of thinking to try to get people to believe in our intuitions carries over into science, but the longer we're scientific, the more that will go away. So we can count on that really not getting in the way either, and we can agree to disagree about some things. But that's... Now, one of the great ironies about that is that determinism requires initial conditions to be known, to know that there's initial conditions and everything has flowed from that point on. And we can't know what those initial conditions are, most likely. And even if we could know what they were like at the beginning of the Big Bang, we don't know what came before the Big Bang, and whether there was something before or something after, and probably we'll never get evidence of that. And so we have to think it through logically. But so to me, the irony of the determinism belief in science is that why are they so fond of determinism? Why are they so fond of saying, I have no free will and I can't do anything except for what is the end result of all these atoms rolling along for all this period of time? And the reason is because those religious ideas that they thought they were getting rid of told them to be afraid of being responsible for their own actions because they were either going to be rewarded or punished for them. And so if they're responsible for those actions, that's what's going to happen. And if they believe in determinism, then there's no rewards and punishments. But I already got rid of rewards and punishments anyway, so they don't need that. They don't need the idea of determinism. And free will, you know, they're upset about free will, but free will, if it's simple, if it's a moral decision, you have moral responsibility if you have free will, and therefore because you have moral responsibility, you'll either be punished or rewarded for something. But if free will is just making decisions, that you can make decisions, then all the animals have free will. Everybody makes decisions. That's what minds do. Everybody makes decisions. And the interesting other part of the scientific theories for now that's missing is that there's really no good explanation of an anti-entropic force. So you've got entropy coming down. You don't have any real explanation for why localized there are anti-entropic things like all of us. You know, why is it that we can build against entropy? Why can we, of course, on a larger scale, as they demonstrate, entropy is still increasing. If we concentrate an anti-entropic force and make things, overall entropy is still increasing. But even so, the idea that you can create localized forms of anti-entropic activity is against the law of entropy. Now, as I said before about water, we may find that, you know, we've only been living with this theory for 400 years, so there may be another form of the law of entropy which has the equivalent of water always goes downhill except for when it evaporates and comes up and comes down again. So there may be another way to explain this, and I'm eager to see what science comes up with in the next couple hundred years about this, because they may have an explanation. But in the meantime, there is no explanation of anti-entropic forces, and the only thing we know that is pushes against the normal flow downhill of matter into less and less organized forms, the only thing that we know that does that are minds. Our minds, animal minds, ants. I'm gonna talk about ants here for a second. Now, there are holes under the ground because of air pockets, volcanic tunnels, things like that. But nothing as sophisticated as what ants build in their homes underneath it. It's very clear that ants are an anti-entropic force. The decisions that they make are anti-entropic locally on their thing. And maybe that's why it was called anti-entropic. I'm not sure. So ants and any other mind, any insect mind, any human mind, any animal mind, they all try to move things around to satisfy their own desires in their search for happiness. That's what I think. So I think that there's a third way of looking at things, which is a sort of an update of Pythagoras' ideas. Now, if you say there's no divine authority, but we live longer than one biological life, and there's no rewards and punishments, but there is something that goes on in our heads, some patterns, which is why we always thought that was true. One of those patterns is that the quality of our happiness is directly related to the quality of our desires. So there's a balance, and it's an immediate balance all the time. The more intelligent our desires are in our pursuit of happiness, in the quality of the desires, and that will create a different quality of happiness in our minds. And that's a balance that takes place moment to moment all the time. It's not based on time. It's based on this process of change. Now, if you have that balance and you project out into the world, you want the world to behave like that. You want the world to say, good will be rewarded. You know, being bad will be punished. And you get to define what good and bad is. And that's why you reward and punish people. But it's just from your own mind projected out onto everything else. Because, to be quite honest, you can always outsmart that process. And now, I said that there are no rewards and punishments. People are saying, okay, yeah, but if he's wrong and I die and I go to hell, I'm going to be really, really mad. So I'll give you some advice just in case I'm wrong. So say I'm wrong and you go to hell. Then you have to learn what a lot of people have learned. That is, you can get around the punishment by beginning to enjoy it. This is what masochists do. And so if you can outsmart the whole game by realizing that all you have to do is shift your desires when you're punished to saying, you know, I deserve that punishment. I'm happy to get that punishment. And therefore, you've just ruined hell. So if I happen to be wrong, remember that. You won't be so mad at me. But really, if you think about it clearly, you'll see that it's true. Lots of people do it. And one of the great ironies of our society that we have all these habits. And if you look at them, you say, that person is trying to punish themselves immediately so they don't get punished later. Why do we do that? Because we have absorbed these ideas. And so we punish ourselves immediately thinking, that's going to get me off the hook. I get to do what's wrong, and I get to punish myself right away at the same time. And therefore, you know, I'm not going to go into it. Okay. But big parts of our culture are based upon that idea. And it's interesting because we're just deceiving ourselves in doing that kind of thing. As I said, just remember the pretty pictures and all the other things that we do that are wonderful, but this is where we're really striking out because we really don't deal with this very clearly. So, this is my annual lecture. I've been doing it for over 20 years. The patterns in our personalities really give us an idea about what we're up to. And I gave a lecture in March of 2011 on the patterns in our personality. That podcast is still available. I gave a lecture in March of 2003 on the pursuit of happiness. Lecture is also still available as a podcast. And the other idea that I want to talk about is transcending cruelty. So we talk about good and evil. We talk about how the Pythagorean approach might change that. And there's a couple of ideas to explain where we got this idea and where we came up with cruelty in the first place, why we became cruel people. And that is pretty simple. And this is another reason, if these ideas become clear, I think it's another idea that can shift the way people think about evil. So one idea is what I call the importance of being important. Okay? We all want to be important. Now, we know that there's financial hierarchies and there's social hierarchies, and we have an idea where we fit in those, and some people try to go up, some people don't care about it, stuff like that. But what everybody does care about is the psychological hierarchy. And ironically, we have no idea of where we fit, and we have no way of judging where we fit, comparing to other people. We don't know if we're happier than other people. It's way too complex to tell. You can have a vague idea whether that person's happy or not, but a lot of people who pretend to be happy and can give people the impression they're happy are not nearly as happy as they pretend. Some people are better actors and actresses than others. But that psychological hierarchy is absolutely crucial to us because it's our importance. And we want to be important. And why do we want to be important? Because we're, as I said at the beginning, we're individual minds in this huge universe, right? And we know it. And the scientists keep telling us the universe is even bigger than we thought. That hasn't helped this situation. Yeah. It was enough when you lived in Europe and you saw the big ocean and you said, you know, we're on a little piece of land surrounded by water. I'm so small, you know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you've only been around, even and human beings have only been around for a couple million years, and a million years is nothing. You know, it's been 14 billion years since the universe exploded into reality, and we're not even sure if that's when it started. So as it gets bigger, we feel smaller, but the fact is we always want to be important. And of course we are important, as I said before. And the way to solve this is not the way we usually do it. It's not by buying a better car than our neighbor. It's not by building a bigger house than the neighbor. It's not all those things that we do to try to prove that we're important. That's not what will work. And the other thing about to show how we really try to stay in the hierarchy, the psychological hierarchy, it's almost a universal experience, not quite, because some people are a little bit above this. It's almost a universal experience that if somebody loses their job, they can even have been good to their family for a long time, they lose their job unexpectedly and are devastated by it, they go home and they're mean to their children and they're mean to their spouse, right? And why? Because they have to make those other people be more miserable than they are so that they can still be in the same situation in the psychological hierarchy in their family that they were before. And this is where cruelty comes from. Cruelty comes from getting pleasure in somebody else's pain because you need them to be in more pain than you are. And so we have created an entire culture based on that idea. That's not the only idea in our culture, but that's one of the ideas. Now, the importance of being important can be solved very simply. Two ideas. One, you're indispensable to yourself. Nobody else can live your life. You're the only one thinking your thoughts. You can express your thoughts to other people. You can express your emotions to other people, but nobody experiences it just like that. Now, people say, no, God, so I've heard this objection, God knows you just as you are. He knows exactly what you're experiencing. He knows exactly what you need. He's inside your mind. He knows it all. So I say, okay, but even God cannot possibly know what it's like to be you as an individual. He might be able to read your mind totally, but he can't get rid of being God while he's paying attention to what you're experiencing. He's God, and he's paying attention. He knows you fully, if that's true at all. And therefore, even he can't squash himself down into just being you. So you are indispensable to your own experience at all times. You can't get any more important than that. Right? Now, the next thing is, you can't be indispensable to other people. Everybody kind of wants to be because they project out that personal indispensability, but you can't actually ever be indispensable to anyone else. Right? And all you have to do is say, but I can solve that anyway. I can still be more important. All I have to do is be more valuable to other people. And to be valuable to other people, all you have to do is give more than you take. It's very simple. You can give a little bit more than you take if you want to be a little stingy about it, but you're still valuable. Or you could give lots more than what you take and become a very valuable member of the community. So that's up to you, but it's not that hard to solve that problem. And transcending cruelty is the other part of my idea. So there's the importance of being important and transcending cruelty. And transcending cruelty is very simple. That is, you just see how to be indispensable to yourself and not cruel and not and be valuable to other people, and see that it's not in your self-interest to be cruel to anybody. It's not in your self-interest, because why would you want to surround yourself with people who are in greater pain than before? Only because of the psychological hierarchy thing. For every other reason, there is no reason to do that. You'd want to be around happier people. You'd want to create happy people around you. And you have a choice. You can be happy in two different ways in society. You can be happy swimming upstream against where everybody is going, or you can be happy going where everybody's going because everybody's happy and everyone's moving in the same direction. Either one is enjoyable. Being with everybody else being happy is probably even better. But if you don't have a choice and you want to swim upstream, that's fine. And, you know, that's another thing to remember if I'm wrong about hell, because you can always swim against the stream there too, and figure out how to get around the rules. That's when deviousness will really be useful. So so those are the three ways of looking at life. You know, and if it's true, if we're individual minds in this universe, it actually makes no difference what your metaphysical theory is about life. You can have any one of those theories, as long as you understand how our personalities work. If you understand how our personalities work, what the patterns are, how to be happier, then you can be happier while you're alive in the present. And if you die, and the scientists are right, and there's nothing, you have nothing to worry about, because there's nothing. You can't be upset. You can't say, oh no, I don't exist, you know, and be mad because you're not there. And so absolutely nothing is painful about that possibility. Absolutely nothing under my getting rid of those three ideas. Absolutely nothing is painful about the possibility that there are divine authorities or one divine authority and your religion was right. So on. As long as he has a sterling character, he's not going to reward or punish you. You're going to still exist, and you're going to be in his club, because that's what those are for. They're just like big clubs. And I think if people kind of start thinking about them a little bit like sports teams that they like, you know, so that they admire that sports team a lot, you know, and so they I'm part of this sports team. We won this weekend. We won the Super Bowl if you're from Kansas City, or we almost won the Super Bowl if you're from San Francisco. And you know, how many of the people were actually playing? But we won, you know? And so I think the same idea, we are individuals in a huge universe. We want to belong to something bigger. And as long as we remember we're individuals, we can belong to something bigger. But I think that that's the function. And if we do exist after we die, that could still be the function. Being part of a bigger group, saying, yes, we are wonderful because whatever excuse you use, whatever game it is that's playing, it doesn't matter. It works. On the other hand, the last idea, if you're an individual and you live longer than just your biological body does, then as long as you understand the game of how happiness is created, you're all set. You're all set forever. Because you understand the rules of the game. We haven't been given a blueprint, but we can figure it out. So I think, as I've said, that if you get rid of those three ideas, you can have three main groups of how people look at life, and they could all agree, because there's no punishment, no anger about which one works, and they could all be. Now, because I used that sports analogy, I thought, you know, maybe we ought not to have a metaphysical Super Bowl every year, you know, because then people will say our team won and your team lost and so on and so forth. So maybe we don't want to get that sporty about it. But I think we can live together about this, these sets of ideas. So the goal of the clear conceptual thinking is to come up with what our shared reality actually is. You know, that was the point of the Greek transformation into using reason. And who we are, you know, we are these individual minds. Either we're going to be part of a group that's a religious group and use our intuition and belong to that group, or we're going to be scientists and think that we die and that we no longer exist. And, you know, nobody's going to punish the scientists who die and then they still exist. You know, and then say, excuse me, but you believed that you weren't going to exist, and therefore you're going to be punished for having thought that. That's another thing about the sterling character. If somebody did set the whole thing up, he would have a sterling enough character to say, you tried to understand the game that I created. Nice job. I mean, you're far off, you know, but you tried to understand the game, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I admire that. You might even get a better seat at the table than the ones who just believed. So because trying to understand is something, you know, if you go through an art gallery and you don't know it, but the artist is there, you go through an art gallery and you go, and then you go, and then somebody else comes and, oh, I really think that this color means that she was in a terrible situation at the time she was painting that one. And you go on like that. And the artist happens to hear and says, you know, you got it all wrong, but I admire that you tried to understand my painting. That's the idea. I think we can understand this. Something of a better personality, I think it'll be very, very clear. So there's nothing to worry about death at all. So we're individuals, and those are the possibilities. And who are we as a group? Well, we're the human race, right? 8 billion of us or so. And who should we be? The humane race. And who will we be? That's up for us. That's up to us, right? You know, we're the ones who get to decide. And you get to be part of whatever section of these sets of ideas there are. So thank you very much for coming. I'll take a couple of questions. I have one question that came in early. It's from a distant relative of mine named Edmund Kuhl. And he asked me, I have always relied on my intuition, and it works very well all the time. Why should I care what our shared reality is? What's all this attempt to find a shared reality? Let me just go with my flow, go with the intuition. And my answer to that is, go ahead, Edmund. Just keep flowing, because first of all, you're not going to do it any other way. And second of all, that's how you feel about it. But I think as people understand the shared reality and the patterns in our personality better, that, you know, something else will become more, it'll become more popular over time to do this. In fact, you know, at this point, after 2.5 millennium of some kind of rational humanitarianism moving into our thinking and the science that has come along with that, that if we keep that up and increase the pace, especially if we can drop some of the ideas that are getting in our way, that might actually amount to 3-5% of the human population in 1,000 years. Then we'll be right up there with the bisexuals in terms of popularity. And so that's basically an important way to understand life. Where is it? How many people are interested in this? How many people are trying to understand versus how many people are intuitively experiencing it? And when you see the patterns in our personalities, you'll see that the intuitional approach makes a whole lot of sense to just go with that flow, but you don't ever get to the rules of the game. You don't get to the blueprint unless you try to break through the errors you're making in your judgment and the fact that all those intuitions don't add up. I mean, they can't all be right at the same time, right? So that's, I mean, so here's a question up here. Can you, for the camera, where should you stand for the camera? Over here? Can you stand over here, Gary? So the camera can catch you or not? Yeah, because it's going to be on video.
What I heard was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest handicap the human being has, is thinking.
Thinking?
You have to be out of your mind.
To think?
Which means you're out of your senses.
Uh-huh.
And we live in our minds and our senses. The middle of the bell curve lives in its mind and its senses. You have to be out of your mind and away from your senses to be where you're, the part of you that you've discussed, living in his intuition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the comment I would make, because everything you talked about was about being in your mind and thinking, and that creates misery because there's no solution. There's no end to that kind of thinking.
Well, my comment, I thought you might say that. My comment, I know Gary very well. Gary and I have been friends for all 15 years here, right, Gary? And we agree to disagree about this, and we're still friends. You know, that it's a very good example of what I'm trying to accomplish. But I think there is a solution. And I have a couple of handouts, actually, that lay out the principles, the patterns in our personalities, and this that I arrived at by thinking to say what it is. And that will save everybody all the misery that you're talking about, Gary. Because it's not a misery if you make progress in your thinking towards something. And if you think that there's a final solution, a state of perfection, that state of perfections are static. And anything that's static doesn't meet with life. I won't go into that. That's an hour's discussion. But I think the idea of perfection is another one of the illusions that we have. Now, I want to talk about one other thing, and that is a lot of people in thinking about do we have a life past, you know, our biological life? And what a lot of people don't realize or don't think about, first of all, this has been speculated on for a long time, but our dreams every night are living in a world of light, right? Inside of our own minds, we create all these things. And if you're fresh when you go to sleep, before you fall asleep, the images start coming into your mind, right? And you can actually see in your own mind clear images taking place, and then you drift off to sleep. But where are those clear images being created? It's almost like you have an internal movie screen, but what you have is you're working with this light. And there's all kinds of stories in the last century because of better medical information and techniques, all kinds of stories about near-death experiences that people have. And it's interesting that almost all of them match up with whatever the person's belief is about life. So it's a little bit like, you know, somebody visiting New York City and they go to Times Square and they say one thing about New York City. They go to the Harlem, they say another thing about New York City. And so everybody is visiting different parts and they're describing it differently. But one thing that's true for everything is that there's light. There's beings of light. They're a being of light. Other people are beings of light. Now, this sounds a little bit mystical, and I'm going to try to take some of that mysticism out, because every single day, every single person is dreaming, and their mind is a being of light, dreaming dreams inside their mind, right? And so it seems to me much simpler to understand, because one of the things that biologically we can't understand is how do we get our thoughts to make our body move. I mean, as everyone knows, well, I'm talking, my hands are doing all kinds of things. I have no idea what they're doing. But they're moving, and my mind is making that happen. And my thoughts are making that happen. And if my thoughts are directed beams of light, or, you know, photons being sent out by something, and we know that every atom is sending out photons. So if we think of it in terms of light, and there's been some experiments done on how much the neurons use photons to pass the information along and so on. A photon going into an atom changes the atom. So if we're trying to figure out how our minds make our bodies do things, I think that's the place to start. I have no idea. It's just guessing. But that is something that we can think about scientifically. So another person? Yeah. Great. Want to ask a question? Hang on 1 second so you have a microphone. Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed in my years is that when you ask a question of someone in the definitive, you know, that's a kind of a yes or no question,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, is there a God?
Right.
Seems to be the big one that people like to ask. People either go loud or they go soft.
Uh-huh.
They want to fight it. You know, they're going to get out the guns one way or the other. My partner had a sneaky little trick because he had a little Buddhist training.
Uh-huh.
He would switch totally to the hypothetical.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, well, should there be such a thing?
Yeah.
You know, where would you find them?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and throw it right back at me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I spent 20 years in Christian Science, and that would knock me off my socks. You know, Mary Baker Eddy gave me seven objects to play with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd usually walk away, not in tears, but not with an answer.
Right.
So I wonder if you want to comment about that.
Sure, sure. It's one of the reasons that I'm very interested in this topic and saying it in a philosophical way, because there's really no reason to argue with people about what they think is true about life. Our personality patterns are clear to me anyway, and in explaining it, you'll see that it's something like that. It's something like that. It's inherent patterns. Our happiness is when we fulfill a desire. That's what it comes from. Our unhappiness is when we don't fulfill a desire. Our love is our attraction to what we find beautiful. Our hatred is what we find is our repulsion from what we find ugly. And why do we find it ugly? Because it doesn't give us happiness. Why do we find it beautiful? Because it brings us happiness, or we expect it to. Our passions are our anticipation of our happiness that we're going to get from something. And our fears are our anticipation of the unhappiness we're going to get from something. So there's a pattern to it. But the qualities of it are all, you know, it's very subtle, and there's a lot to explain about it. So, but when it comes to this religious idea and the discussion, if you do it in a hypothetical way, and you don't say, no, you've got to think my way. We don't, you know, people don't even argue, aren't willing to agree that 2 + 2 = 4. No. Some people say, well, when you go on the surface of a sphere, then it can equal more than 4. Well, yes, but it's no longer a flat plane, and that's where we were, you know. So yes, of course, we can change the boundaries, and then you have a different answer. That doesn't really go against the principle. And the principles are clear, and I think that's where we have common ground, or we can get common ground, and the more common ground we have, the easier it will be to get along. But I also would like to say that there's no reason that we all have to get along, clearly, because we don't. You know, and history shows what happens, and even so, we're much less violent than we were 5,000 years ago, and we're much less cruel in many ways, and the institution of slavery, which is absolutely terrible form of cruelty, and also a very, very much based on the importance of being important, that also is, you know, kind of on its way out. We're kind of very slowly catching on as to what it is that could make us all a little bit happier living together. But if we never catch on, life is still way worthwhile. There's all kinds of beautiful things going on, all up and down, all around the world. There's all kinds of awful things going on. But, you know, contribute to the better things. Like my father said when he came in one time, and my brother and I were playing, and we were knocking over each other's blocks. He walked through the room, and he paused, and he looked back and says, "Boys, be constructive, not destructive. It's the civilized thing to do." And it's that simple, you know. It might be the underdog to be civilized. It might be easier to destroy than it is to create and be constructive. But it's much more fun, you know. And you're not surrounded by as many miserable people. It's just amazing how important that psychological hierarchy must be for us to be doing something that really does hurt us all the time, individually. Hurts us more than it hurts the other people. And again, you can be devious and get out of it. Someone's trying to make you miserable, because they're being cruel. The easiest way to solve the problem is to not become miserable like they want you to. You know, to not give in to the pain, to not become, not experience the pain, even to laugh at it. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of dealing with it. But I can tell you that anybody who's a bully that finds out that you're not going to succumb to their bullying is going to find somebody else. It's unfortunate for the other person, but they're going to do it anyway. So that's an important part of how we look at these things. I'm just thinking of a quote from The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain. He said, I have revealed yourself to yourself, so go on and dream other dreams, but better ones. You know? That's really basically what we're up to as human beings, at least some of us. And it does seem like a very good way to pursue happiness. But while we're doing it, it's very important to be realistic, I think, because otherwise we get off in a dream world and then we don't accept the reality of every individual pursuing happiness and doing it their way, not our way. And that's why I say that there is no myth so irrational that no one will believe it. And there is no truth so obvious that everyone will accept it. So we're not trying to get everybody to agree. That's not necessary. Agree on some basic rules to the game, and then everybody play the game differently. Some people, you know, baseball's still around. Some people want to be the catcher. Some people want to be the pitcher. Someone want to be in the outfield. Some can be good at offense. Some are better at defense. It all makes for the game to be interesting. The only thing we don't want are the cruel people. You know, the only thing that really ruins the game are cruel people. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 122nd year of Enlightened Discussion. Thanks a lot for coming.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.